now shift to the topic of futurism. The imprint of Buckminster Fuller on the American landscape is most often seen in his invention called the geodesic dome, which inspired those odd-looking bubble houses that occasionally catch your eye as you drive through unfamiliar neighborhoods. But Fuller's impact on the intellectual landscape of futurist thought was much greater. The late engineer, inventor, philosopher, and cartographer is credited with creating a self-sustaining vision for planet Earth, which has inspired many people to imagine the world in the same way. This week, the San Diego Rep will mount a play based on the life of Fuller. Today, we're going to be talking about the late futurist and find out what today's futurists are predicting. We're joined by two in-studio guests. Peter Meisen is president of Global Energy Network Interaction, a San Diego organization founded on the principles of Buckminster Fuller. We're also joined in studio by David Brin, a San Diego-based futurist and science fiction writer. And David, Peter, thanks very much for coming in today.
Great to be here, Tom.
Good to be here.
Well, Peter Meisen, you must have a pretty high opinion of Buckminster Fuller to base an organization on his ideas.
True. I really discovered Bucky when my father, 30 years ago, took me to see him speak at MiraCosta College. And I was a high school senior. He had one of his famous 3-4-hour lectures that I was inspired. I fell asleep. I was entranced and really didn't know what he said. I wasn't mature enough at the time to really get the message. But I did commit to really studying his work. And in 1985, read the book Critical Path, which was his really seminal work at the end of his life. And there was one line in that book that really inspired me to take on an initiative called that we called the Genie Initiative. Has to do with linking electrical systems around the world, tapping renewable energy resources. And this was the premier strategy from his World Game simulation.
And Genie, that's the acronym for your group, right? The Global Energy Network Interaction?
It's actually Global Energy Network Institute.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's okay. I'm sorry. Well, anyway, Buckminster Fuller must have been pretty talented if he could cause you to be inspired and fall asleep all at the same time.
Well, that was a long time ago. When I did see him speak a little bit later, I was riveted on every single word that he spoke, and really one of the true geniuses of our century. Not many people knew him other than those that saw him speak in colleges and universities around the world or read his work. He's one of those unknown eclectic geniuses.
Well, the San Diego Rep, as I mentioned, is going to be doing a play, presenting a play based on the life of Buckminster Fuller. Can you tell us a little bit about him? Where was he born? Where was he from? What was his education? And how did he become such an influential person?
Wow, that's probably a
that's a lot of questions.
That's
I realize.
A lot of questions. I know, born in Maine and went to Harvard twice and was kicked out twice. That's probably as much history as I would care to jump into right now. I think the fundamental shift and experience in his life was at a time when he was at his lowest and considered contemplating suicide on the shores of Lake Michigan. He was penniless, had a new dog. Had no prospects, but a tremendous amount of experience in his background, and really started to, what he said, think for himself rather than having other people think for him, and said that he didn't have the right to eliminate himself. He belonged to the universe, and he was going to commit himself to humanity, and that really was a life-changing time.
Is it possible to sum up his philosophy about the future in a sentence or a phrase?
I would probably say he looked to reform the environment. He looked to create artifacts and tools that made our society more efficient, use less resources, use less energy, so that everybody could have a decent standard of living around the world. And that was in contradistinction to trying to reform man, which is incredibly difficult because there's so many of us and we have so many different opinions and thoughts. But if you created a better environment through inventions and tools that old ways of doing things, war being one of them, would just become obsolete because we now knew we had enough resource, enough technical know-how to provide decent quality of life for everybody.
Would you call him a utopian thinker?
Yes, but also a realistic thinker. He did the studies of resource distribution, of where what people needed in terms of providing adequate quality of life, and in that study realized that there there was enough for everybody. And so he would design based on that so that we could actually meet everybody's needs, which some people would then say is utopian, but he said we had the realistic option to make it on the planet today.
Well, David Brin, let me turn to you. As a science fiction writer and a self-proclaimed futurist, was Buckminster Fuller an inspiration to you?
Oh, of course, on several levels. Even though he didn't have an advanced education officially, he was a person who believed in fulfilling the promise of the availability of knowledge, which was established in our culture by another Renaissance man, Benjamin Franklin. It's interesting to compare these lives with 400 years ago, almost today, but last month was the 400th anniversary of the burning at the stake of Giordano Bruno, a so-called heretic back in the Renaissance, who said that the twinkling little stars in the sky must be suns with planets surrounding them and other possibly other life forms curious about us. That kind of thinking got him burned. That kind of thinking got Benjamin Franklin on our money and got Buckminster Fuller to be acclaimed as one of the great crackpot inspirational leaders of this century. It is a sign of our health that we accept eccentrics, especially when the eccentrics aren't too ideological, when they say, look, don't oversimplify humanity. Instead, let's try to solve problems. And that's the kind of example he set.
Peter, do you agree that Buckminster Fuller was a bit of an eccentric?
Absolutely. In his life, he irritated people. He challenged institutions. Invented a dome that said, "Here is a structure that really could replace the way we build a structure in our society because it weighs so much less. It's so much stronger. It encompasses more space than our boxes that we build today. But nobody really has embraced it as an ideal living system." System because it's so outside the norm.
Well, I actually have to disagree just a little here. If you actually take a look at Buckminster Fuller's inventions and the things that he thought would change the world, the Nijmegen car, the geodesic dome, the Nijmegen house, it turns out that there were actually very good commercial and economic reasons why many of these things just were considered impractical at the time and have never really took their place. For instance, as an ex-hippie, I can tell you, having lived in a geodesic dome, that thousands were built by Buckminster Fuller enthusiasts over the years, and they leaked like hell. It's hard to implement them really well. Where Buckminster Fuller had his true influence was on literally tens, perhaps even hundreds of thousands of people who saw him as a role model for poking away. You asked earlier what simple phrase would distill him. I would say, question everything and then ask, can this be done better? And if you can think of a way it can be done differently, at least invent some time and energy into checking out the most bizarre possibilities.
Well, we're going to continue this conversation after a short break. You're listening to These Days, and we're talking about the life and influence of Buckminster Fuller and asking the question, what are futurists predicting today? The number to call if you want to join this conversation when we return is 888-895-KPBS.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Fudge. You're listening to These Days on KPBS, and we're talking about the future, the past, and the future of futurism. We're joined in studio by Peter Meisen, president of Global Energy Network, the Global Energy Network Institute, I have to get it right this time, a San Diego nonprofit organization founded on the principles of Buckminster Fuller, and David Brin, a San Diego-based science fiction writer, physicist, and futurist. If you want to give us a call and let us know what you think about Bucky Fuller, as he's known to his close friends, or was known to his close friends, or talk about visions of the future, the number is 888-895-5727. Well, David Brin, you're a science fiction writer, a writer of science fiction, and fairly successful one. Has Buckminster Fuller been an inspiration to your writing?
Well, of course. I mean, basically, we live in a civilization, as I said before, that if you're a fairly harmless and interesting eccentric, it's not going to burn you at the stake. Instead, it's going to pay you money. He never got rich off of any of his inventions, but he always got a lot of good speaking gigs. And I'm getting a lot now today, so I'm perfectly happy. He inspired a great many people with his style, his panache, his interest, his verve. For instance, a major class of chemical compounds, carbon compounds, has been named Buckminster Fullerenes after the geodesic dome shape that he developed.
Because they're spherical?
Because they form carbon chains that loop around on themselves either in spirals, loops, or the most famous ones are in the forms of soccer ball shapes, carbon 60, carbon 70. And it turns out that there may be some wonderful practical uses of these materials, which he did not predict, but people who were inspired by him thought, "Oh, this has to be named after Bucky."
Peter, what do you think about that chemical discovery? Do you think that proves anything that Buckminster Fuller was trying to prove by creating the geodesic dome?
What Bucky did is he looked to nature and said, "How does nature build structure? How does nature use mathematics as opposed to our Euclidean XYZ coordinate system?" So he ultimately invented a mathematical system based on triangles and the tetrahedron, because that's how nature builds structure. To go back a little bit about, if you're ahead of your time, sometimes you're way ahead of your time and people think that you're crackpots. He created the Dymaxion car, which, when you look at it, looks a lot like a teardrop. And this was in the 1930s when the Model A was the car of the day. And this car was streamlined. It was energy efficient. It could turn 90 degrees. It was three wheels. And it was so far ahead of its time, people said, "Well, that's just, that's just outlandish." Today, all those same design principles are in the cars that we produce today because they make good sense, energy efficiency, streamlined. That kind of design principle is evident. And one that I found fascinating, basically, in the work that we do on interconnecting energy systems, which he predicted was a strategy 30 years ago out of the World Game. On Thursday's paper, the same day the Night and Day came out with the cover story of the Union, had to do with power sharing here in San Diego.
The power plant in Rosarito.
That's exactly right. That Sempra and ABB, the big conglomerate out of Zurich, was going to retrofit the Rosarito power plant from an oil-fired power plant to a gas power plant that would expand the electrical capacity throughout northern Baja with excess energy to sell to San Diego. A win-win deal for everybody. And Bucky said 30 years ago, here's the strategy that we ought to be pursuing around the world.
Let's go to Peggy in Pacific Beach. By the way, the number is 888-895-5727. Peggy, go ahead. You're on These Days.
Hello. Hello, Peter Meisen. This is Peggy Budd calling.
Hi, Peggy.
And I want to honor you in all the work you've done with Bucky's ideas. And I want to say how inspired I was back in the 60s when I heard Buckminster Fuller speak in New York City. And we started the first World Games there. And we had no computers, but we tried to figure out how the world's physical properties could be used to make everybody on Earth a billionaire, which is what he had hoped. And I also wanted to quote Norman Cousins, who was a good friend of Bucky's, and he felt that Bucky's greatest contribution was that he had a great respect for human potential and the human mind, and that there were no boundaries to the human mind. And I think that's one of the things that Buckminster Fuller tried to portray.
You know, Peggy, I'm curious about the personality of this guy. We've described him as being brilliant, eccentric, inspiring. What was he like in person, and what was he like as a speaker?
Well, he did speak on and on and on, and you did have to really concentrate, and people who were smart brought their lunch or dinner at these gatherings. But he was absolutely down to the human level, and on one of his visits to San Diego, when he did a book signing at a local bookstore, he got up in the middle of it. This was just before the Equal Rights Amendment was to be decided, and read a two-page treatise that he had just written, that the Equal Rights Amendment was absolutely vital for people to consider and pass, so that we could all meet our human potential and get this world into a place that was fit for all of us.
Okay, well, Peggy, thank you very much for calling. David, you want to respond to that?
Well, except for the sound of pigeons in the background for Peggy, you must be in a pigeon coop right now.
Well, actually, she's in PB, so they might be seagulls.
But I think that one of the important things that Buckminster Fuller did was to push for environmentalism, especially for a sense of perspective. The spaceship Earth concept that he brought in very early on was reified when we got those wonderful pictures back from the most important space mission worth the entire space program, which was the Apollo 8 mission, which orbited the moon, not the Apollo 11 that landed on the moon. They brought back the most valuable gift that we ever got from outer space, and that was the image of the Earth floating in space as an oasis, and a work of art that changed our attitudes forever. And the hole in which this tree was planted had been dug by Buckminster Fuller.
And Peter, when did he coin that expression, Spaceship Earth?
There was a book called Operating Manual for Spaceship Earth, and really was, I think, the book that launched his awareness around the world about global thinking. The phrase, think global, act local, also was his invention, which now everybody speaks as a casual comment.
When did that book come out, though? It was called The Manual for Spaceship?
Operating Manual for Spaceship Earth. I believe it was the late 60s. I don't know the exact publication date.
Okay, well, Peggy mentioned a game. I think she called it the World Game.
Correct.
Or something like that. I think that's a game you played. Tell us about that.
It's a fabulous four-hour experience, and it's really the best global, visceral education I know of for people to understand the issues and the situations on the planet and to work on strategies to make it better for everybody. We've actually hosted it here in the past at Shiley Studio. It's using his Dymaxion map, which is a unique map made up of triangles, and it's the most accurate flat map of the world you've ever seen. This particular map for the World Game is the size of a basketball court, and 100 people play at one time. So you have each person represents 1% of humanity. 7 people stand in North America, and 22 people go crowd over in India. And you then pass out resources like breadsticks for caloric intake and candles for energy use and other resource distribution. And the first thing you definitely see is this enormous inequity in the world in terms of resources and monetary availability, those kind of things. And then you actually start working on strategies to make the planet a better place for everyone. The World Game purpose statement, and I'll say it in total because this will sort of honor Bucky's statement, was how do you make the world work for 100% of humanity in the shortest period of time through spontaneous cooperation without ecological damage or disadvantage to anyone, i.e. how do you make the planet a better place for everybody and not damage the environment in the process? And we'll be hosting that game in May, on May 6th, here in San Diego, and it's a terrific experience.
David Brin, I said at the top of the show, or suggested at the top of the show, that Buckminster Fuller had a very optimistic view of technology and what technology will do for us or can do for us in the future. Would you agree with that, and what do you think about his view of technology.
Well, we live in an era in which technology is forcing rapid changes on us, and this is one of the reasons why I chose the genre of writing that I'm in. You know, science fiction deals with how change affects human beings. The fact is that many people suffer from anomie. They suffer from an alienation from the modern world, and a prescription you often hear is to return to the past. Well, if you really study the past and how people lived, you realize that it was vicious, oppressive, and our ancestors got us to this modern world by working very, very hard and innovating. They did it on purpose, not so we could go back to a rather brutal, nasty life. That doesn't mean that technology doesn't have serious consequences and serious drawbacks. But what Buckminster Fuller was trying to point out, and a great many hardworking, several million hardworking people on this continent alone are trying to point out, is that the way through this problem is by forging ahead through it, past it, by becoming wise enough that we can then simplify again. The computers are already showing the way. We can make things smaller and use less energy and less impact by understanding the laws of nature better. And that's I think, where his essential optimism, as you point out, comes in.
You're listening to These Days. Our guests are Peter Meisen and David Brin. Peter is president of the Global Energy Network Institute in San Diego, and David is a San Diego-based science fiction writer, physicist, and futurist. If you want to give us a call to talk about futurism or Buckminster Fuller, the number is 888-895-5727. Jess is in La Mesa. Jess, go ahead. You're on These Days.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Buckminster Fuller, I've been fascinated by his work for, you know, since the 70s. And one of the things that your guest just mentioned is, you know, the difficulties in the past. And I'd like to just point out the context, some of the context of Bucky's life. You know, growing up in Maine, and his great aunt, I think it is Margaret Fuller, who was part of the Transcendentalist movement out of New England, and she hung around with the likes of Ralph Waldo Emerson and Henry Thoreau, you know, the people that were doing the Transcendental thing. But a lot of what Buckminster Fuller has, his writing has a mystical quality to it. I think one of the fascinations I had, and a lot of people that I hear, you know, become passionate about Buckminster Fuller because it addresses something in our minds that is mystical. It's you know, it's like one of his books is titled "No More Secondhand God," for instance, and he evokes these mystical, poetic, and aesthetic images with the brilliance of the way that he puts ideas next to each other and creates these grand juxtapositions of history and technology and the future, and he basically reflects the innate potential in all of us, and it's just an incredible thing. And I, you know, the context of his life is for me a very important aspect of understanding who he is and was, and the gifts that he gave, and you know, how they came to him in his life. I think he got thrown out of Harvard because it was too small a place for him. And in some ways, every organization he was always signed up for all kinds of, every organization he could, he signed up for. But the ones that had criteria about how you'd be there, you know, they really couldn't contain the vastness and the expansiveness of his manner.
Okay, well, Jess, thanks very much for your call. Peter, do you think it's significant that that the forebears of Buckminster Fuller were the Transcendentalists of New England?
I do. There was part of his mission was to really marry, if you will, and bring together humanistic thought and the scientific community, that oftentimes they're believed to be completely at odds with one another. One is completely belief-oriented, and you have to trust in some higher being, and the other is purely an investigation, and only what you can see and prove is what you can say is right. And Bucky really looked at, if we go back to, again, the earlier discussion on how nature builds itself, how nature's mathematical system works, and the elegance of that, whether it be the atom looks so much like a galaxy, there must be something going on that's both spiritual and scientific at the same time. And he really did, I think, almost better than anyone, marry those two schools of thinking.
Frank is in Normal Heights. Frank, you're on These Days. Go ahead.
Hello. Well, I had the privilege of interviewing Buckminster Fuller some years ago. This was at the old Harkert Brace Jovanovich bookstore in downtown San Diego. He was here, I think this must have been around 1986 or 87 when the book came out. And I found him to be just a marvelous man. The surprising thing to me at the time, I was doing radio news on KFSD. Only two reporters turned out at the before the book signing to interview him. Me and old Herb Lockwood from the Daily Transcript. He sat there with us for about an hour and explained the thoughts behind the book. Sat down and doodled on a blank piece of paper to explain the Dymaxion globe, and I still have that page of doodles. I just wish I'd had him sign it.
Dymaxion. Now, what does that mean, Frank?
That's the same concept, I guess, that produced the car and the dome. The idea is of projecting the spherical surface of the Earth onto a flat surface, so you end up with a bunch of linked hexagons, as I recall.
Maybe one of our guests can define that for us. What does Dymaxion mean?
It's a combination of three words, and I certainly hope I get them right. One is dynamic, then also maximum, and then tension and compression. Tension and compression is a generalized principle that where those two things always and only coexist. Dynamic in obviously the universe being a dynamic system, and his ideas were always about the concept of ephemeralization, doing more and more with less and less resources, energy, time. So we're always in a dynamic change. Change is constant, and he spoke about his meeting with Einstein and where that was proven in that equation that change is constant in our universe, and then also doing the maximum part of that was doing the maximum with the minimum amount of resources. So that's where Dymaxion came from.
David, does it surprise you that only a couple of reporters would show up to interview an old intellectual during a book tour in San Diego?
Oh, well, it doesn't surprise me very much. Look, it's always a case of the glass half empty, glass half full. I earlier pointed out that, Bucky wasn't burnt at the stake like Giordano Bruno's. Obviously, it's half full. He influenced hundreds of thousands of people. The half empty is that during his heyday, there was the Depression to deal with, and then the McCarthy era, in which almost anything enthusiastic was considered to be lefty. And therefore suspect. He had to deal with a life full of frustrations in which a great many of his best ideas did not get tried. And this was a difficult thing. But I'd say that the glass winds up more than half full. Whenever a person like Freeman Dyson gets a theological award for $1 million like he did last year, the great physicist and great nice guy Freeman Dyson, when Buckminster Fuller gets plays made about him posthumously and he's thought of as a great theologian in his own right, I think we're members of a civilization that he would approve of.
You're listening to These Days. We need to take a short break, and when we return, we will continue talking about the future and Buckminster Fuller. And if you want to join our conversation, call us at 888-895-KPBS. I'm Tom Fudge. You're listening to These Days on KPBS. We're talking about futurism this hour, and particularly the life and times and influence of Buckminster Fuller, the late Buckminster Fuller. We're joined in studio by Peter Meisen, president of the Global Energy Network Institute, a San Diego nonprofit organization founded on the principles of Bucky Fuller, and David Brin, a San Diego-based science fiction writer, physicist, and futurist. He's the author of the novel Earth. If you want to give us a call, the number is 888-895-5727. That's 888-895-KPBS. Peter Meisen, let's pick up on a point that was made earlier in the show when we had Peggy, who was calling in from Pacific Beach, and she was talking about this notion Buckminster Fuller had that if we all work together, the resources that are available on Earth will make all of us billionaires. Billionaires?
Yes, that's one of those comments that people would say, well, he must be a crackpot. But he actually looked at it in a totally different context. Bucky was born in 1895, so approximately 100 years ago, a little over right now, at a time when there were no telephones, no cars, refrigeration, medical care was nominal, life expectancy was about half of what it is today. And when he started to actually look at and get into the world game work, he did those trend studies of how people actually lived at that period, at that point in time, and our trends of quality of life that have accrued over those successive decades. And when he was born, the highest standard of living were the popes and the industrialists of the time. There was 1.5 billion people on the planet. And less than 1% of the population had what would be considered a quality standard of life. I mean, they had enormous servants to live that way. Fast forward now, 100 years later, we have 6 billion people, so four times as many people. Half the planet has an extraordinary quality of life, where you and I take for granted cell phones and adequate nutrition and refrigeration and quality of life. You and I right now have a higher standard of living than the highest quality of life 100 years ago by the top potentates and industrialists. The average person lives better than the same person did 100 years ago. So in his perspective, we have, again, four times as many people, 50-folded our ability to provide quality of life from 1% to 50%. So we have 200 times improved our ability to deliver decent standard of living, which was all done through this invisible realm of doing more and more with less and less, getting smarter in our ability to communicate, to produce refrigeration systems that protect medicines and foods, to provide adequate quality of water for drinking and sewer systems so we don't die from that that same waste. That's where that billionaire comment comes from. It's not about money. It's about the ability to have quality of life.
Okay, I was gonna say I'm still waiting for my $1 billion, but
you're already there.
Oh, okay. Well, David, am I already there? What do you think about that comment?
Well, let's make this a very Fuller type discussion. Let's doodle with geometric figures. Throughout most of human history, most people lived in pyramid shaped or triangular shaped cultures, with a few at the top lording it over vast masses below. And it was in the interests of the leadership to keep those masses ignorant, because it was only them. Only a little bit of room at the top. The great golden age of Athenian democracy was an expansion of the ruling class temporarily from 1% to 7% for a couple generations. We have instead in America, in North America today, a social structure that's shaped like a diamond. The well-off, the middle class, outnumbers the poor and the rich. Now, some might say that this isn't as special as it sounds at first, because some at the left would say that it's really on a pyramid of the third world. This is disprovable very easily. What it is it's on the back of a pyramid that is of servants, invisible servants called machines. In your average American middle class home, you have more servants who will act faster to give you a midnight snack than the Pharaoh could have by clapping his hands and ordering them to grind wheat to make him a midnight snack. It would be ready by dawn. So this is an important aspect of the invisibility of miracles. When you give miracles to everybody, I sometimes ask audiences, how many of you have flown through the sky? And kids will raise their hands thinking, what, are you an idiot? Of course I have. How many of you have walked into a darkened room and made light erupt with an action of your fingertip? Well, these used to be the powers of gods, and we take them for granted because we've given them to everybody. And if that's the price we must pay, if we just ignore the airplanes flying over us because everybody can fly. You know, back in the 1920s, Buckminster Fuller would grab people by the scruff of the neck, point up at the sky and say, look, there goes a flying man. You could do that too.
Let's go to Richard in Kensington. Richard, you're on These Days.
Yes, I look at the past as a utopia, not as a dystopia, as these wet-behind-the-ears futurologists. In 1971, a bunch of anthropologists got together with Margaret Mead and the Social Science Research Council and printed a book about how independence and self-sufficiency and a better life was lived years ago, where everybody did their own work. They saw life as a whole. They didn't see everybody's specialization. And these people who want to put everybody into this global anthill of 6 billion people who are so fragile that if one person sneezes, the other person gets a disease. I think basically what we're supposed is the future in this world is less people, more independence, more localism, and less interdependence. And my view, I'm going to hang up now, but my view is that people have to look to the past for the better part of life and not to this faux future.
Okay.
Okay,
Richard in Kensington, thanks.
Unlike a lot of grouches, I liked that guy. He was brief, he was to the point, and he actually made a couple of points that future-oriented people definitely have to answer the indictments that he made. Now, several of his indictments are easily answered. One, that it is demonstrable that romanticizing the past is ridiculous. Sure, there were some advantages occasionally when you had good health to walking down a bucolic lane and saying hi to your neighbor. On the other hand, the nastiness, the disease, the brutishness, the oppression, the ignorance, yuck. On the other hand, he makes very good points when he says that we need to live in a world in which life is more personal, in which people have more of a sense of control over their own personal lives. Buckminster Fuller recommended that we do this by A, unleashing birth control, B, by doing the one thing that keeps population rates down, and that is respect for women and education for girls. C, by developing technologies that enable small communities, think globally, act locally, that enable small groups, families, and communities to actually produce some of their own energy, to produce some of their own food, to have your own rooftop roof shingles, the shingles on your house could be developing solar energy. The way to get these things, ironically, a smaller population, more empowered communities, and empowered individuals who grow some of their own food and produce some of their own energy, is into the future, past the days of big mega corporations providing everything for us.
Well, you know, Richard raises political questions about the interdependency of the world, and I guess he was saying that we need less of that, not more of it. Peter, what was the political vision of Buckminster Fuller?
Ultimately, it was an interesting solution, he said, for the world was to look at the planet as a spaceship, and we have 200 countries now. At the time you spoke about this, it was about 150, and that each political leader acts as an admiral for their part of the ship. And that there's a number of admirals that own most of the energy resources, and they think they own it all. And there's a number of admirals that own most of the food resources, and so they control it all. But ultimately, you start to trade, and you get into this huge trade imbalance that we experience today. And he called those admirals and those political boundaries really blood clots to the free flow of information and resources, that if we can take the political boundaries off, ultimately, which is quite a ways away, But we also see this happening in the European Union right now, where enormous boundaries have gone down for the free flow of goods and services in that region, where they would immediately predict GNP to go up because of that. That the more that we trade with one another, the more that we have resources of supply and demand that go back and forth freely, that everybody will benefit.
Well, David Brin, you know, I want to raise an issue about a conference which you recently attended, which had to do with the wearable internet. And I guess I want to sort of talk a little bit about where we go from here. Tell us about this conference. What were some of the kinds of technologies you were looking at?
Well, that's actually very closely related to what Peter was just saying. Buckminster Fuller thought that we would have to, in order to create this more independent, individual-oriented and less country-oriented world, that we'd have to actually have revolutions tear down the political existence of nations. In my book, The Transparent Society, I recently pointed out that we are achieving this instead by raising up the power of individuals instead of smashing the importance of nations. And we're doing this in many ways through the internet, by making it possible for the individual to simply reach out and get the open information that he or she needs in order to hold others accountable and to find out what they need to accomplish, what they need to do in their own lives. Now, this conference was the Wearable Internet Conference in San Francisco a couple of weeks ago. I was a speaker up there. And the notion is that pretty soon we'll be able to carry the internet with us. You'll have a little tiny pouch on your belt. Your eyeglasses will connect to the internet and automatically be scanning anything you're looking at, your sunglasses. If you're walking down the street, your glasses will pick up the faces of anybody passing by, look them up in a commercial face database, and look up the profile that each of these people has put up about themselves, and you'll see captions underneath the faces of the people you're walking by, their names, their personal profiles, maybe their dating preferences if you're in the market. You could have put your own dating preferences on the internet, which means that if you're walking down the street and some beautiful woman glances at you and then bursts out laughing, maybe you ought to revise it. What you're going to see is a return to the old village that our caller was talking about, in which we all knew everybody we encountered. Only it's going to be a village of 6 billion people, and your memory will be enhanced by vast databases, so that you'll know everybody just like in an Andy Hardy movie. Mickey Rooney knew everybody on the street. Will this be good? Will this be bad? It is coming. That's an absolute fact. But what can we do to keep it from being the horrible, oppressive village like was portrayed in Babbitt, and instead a really nice village like portrayed in Andy Hardy movies? That is still in our power.
Peter Meisen, the way the internet is turning the world into a global village, do you think that fits nicely with what Buckminster Fuller saw as the future of the world?
Absolutely. He proposed ultimately the ideal democracy is where everybody has the ability to get all the information and vote immediately, and the internet may take us in that direction where we all can get as much information as we want about an issue, and whether it be through glasses or through our TV that's web connected, we can all register our vote at that time.
Okay, well, I'd like to thank our guests for joining us today. We have been speaking with Peter Meisen, president of the Global Energy Network Institute, a San Diego organization founded on the principles of Buckminster Fuller. We're also joined by David Brin, a San Diego-based futurist and science fiction writer. He's the author of the novel Earth. Thanks also to our listeners and those who called up to join our discussion. I'm Tom Fudge, and you've been listening to These Days on KPBS.